This is an interview with Governor Attia. This is tape 42, side 2.
I have to kind of back up and tell you, after my first visit, and again, speaking with Kissinger, and he told me the story. He said, you know, when I was doing the shuttle thing, and we got to a matter of discussing getting together, that is now Israel and Syria, to do some discussing about peace. And he was going back and forth. And finally he got an agreement from Israel, so he went back to Damascus and was talking with President Assad. Now this is Kissinger telling me this story. And he said, now here's the plan, and here's how we plan to do it, and you know, where we'll meet, and President Assad's listening to all this. And he said, Mr. President, what do you think? Well, it sounds okay. And Kissinger said, you know, I thought to myself, God, this is easy. A lot easier than I thought it was going to be. And then Kissinger said to me, I said to the President, well, Mr. President, is there any question that I should have asked that I didn't? And President Assad said, yes, you should have asked me if I'm going.
If what?
If I'm going. He said, I don't care what the schedule is. I don't care what your plan is. I'm not going. And I thought that was a pretty funny story, which incidentally I repeated to the President the second time I met with him. And he remembered it vividly. He was kind of laughing at it as well. That, yeah, you should have asked me, am I going? So Kissinger thought he had a pretty easy time. Well, now let's go back to 1984. I would say, incidentally, the visits I always felt were worthwhile. I always enjoyed them. I looked forward to meeting with the President. Oftentimes, it wasn't easy. And particularly the last time, there's a lot of people want the President's time, mm-hmm. and he's busy quite a bit. As a matter of fact, this last time that I mentioned to you, I kept saying, when can I have an appointment, because I wanted to go to my dad's village and spend some time. But I could never, I said, you know, if he says to me, oh, maybe in 2-3 days, that's okay, then I'll go to the village. But I didn't want to go to the village if I had an appointment. Well, finally on a Saturday afternoon, I got the call and said, well, you go ahead and go to the village, but be back by Monday. Mm-hmm. Well, as it turned out then, I just had one night and I couldn't do it on Saturday, it was too late to go then. So I went on Sunday and stayed overnight and came back. Bit of a disappointment to me. I wanted to spend more time in my dad's village, but didn't work out that way. But I really appreciated the opportunity of talking with the President. And you know what I'm telling you now, I never really have told, you know, this is not anything for, well, I think very few people, if anybody, know what I've just talked about. But just because this was not something that I wanted public. This would have to be very quiet. Mm-hmm. And no one really should ever know, if we were actually doing it, no one should ever really know that we were doing it, ever. Because it has to be between countries, and a guy like me just.
What happened during the Persian Gulf War when they were really courting Assad, the United States and the UN really courting Assad for his support in the Persian Gulf War?
He supported it.
Did anybody contact you or?
No.
To try to talk to
no.
somebody in Syria?
No. No, they'd never take me up on it, ever.
Yeah.
That was very interesting, because Syria was supportive of it, and President Assad was supportive of it. The one thing he said, he just couldn't actually send troops to shoot at his fellow Arabs.
Right.
So actually being on their side and saying, I support what you're doing, was pretty powerful medicine enough. And I think they respected the fact that he may have been, Syrian forces may have been in some kind of supporting role, but they would not be frontline shooting. Assad and Saddam Hussein are bitter enemies of one another. They both are Ba'ath parties. But they really don't like each other at all. It was Syria that cut off the pipeline. It was an Iraqi pipeline, oil pipeline going through Syria.
Right.
It was Syria that cut it off, which incidentally I thought was not a very smart move at the time, because Syria has a real problem with foreign reserves, dollars to do things with. People are not allowed to buy new cars because they don't make cars in Syria, so right. they'd have to send money out of the country to get a car. They drive around there what we call classics here, they're using over there. The greatest business in Syria is an auto repair business, because trucks are all old and the cars are old, and the only one that has any decent cars are the big shots, and they're to have Mercedes and things like that. They, you know, in terms of dollars for Syria, their economy is not as strong as it ought to be, or could be. Then there's a PR thing, you know. I've told, when I was there last time again, I met with one of the cabinet officials, who incidentally went to New York University. His wife is an American wife, and he's been consistently a big shot in the Syrian government over the years, and he's a cabinet official, which is kind of interesting, because those folks kind of come and go. And I said, you know, I can help you. I'm talking about the economy. But you have to help me help you, meaning, you know, we Americans don't think a great deal of Syria, and so you've got to get some PR that would be favorable. And along that line was that there's a proposal for peace. Assad finally said, well, okay, I think that's, we ought to do something about that. And I said, you know, he should have jumped in right away. You bet. We've got to have some peace talks. Now, he's not committing himself to anything. Land for peace or whatever, Golan Heights or anything. He's just saying, yeah, that's a good idea. We really ought to do that. So that's kind of a good word coming out of there. Just PR, that kind of PR thing. They still today, they're looking anxiously to try to develop their country. They have great potential. And I would tell you that Syria is an absolutely marvelous historical place to go visit. And there are places like, and I've been to Palmyra, huge Roman city at one time, way out in the middle of nowhere. And you go out there and you see the ruins mostly, but there's still a lot of walls standing and pillars standing, columns. And you can see it, you know, as you look. And when I was out there, you know, here's this beautiful, this wonderful, wonderful place to visit. Nobody's there. I mean, it's not like going to the Acropolis or or the pyramids. And here it is, right by my dad's village. Very close to the village is the best unrestored Crusader castle in the entire Middle East. It sits up on a hill, and it's a marvelous thing. And besides that, I mean, I read a book. There's just all kinds of places like that in Syria. They're not really equipped really as much as they could be for tourists. They have good roads, but once you leave Damascus, although I shouldn't say, I didn't see the accommodation in Homs, which is another large city. But the Western accommodations are great in Damascus. Mm-hmm. But once you get out in the country, it's a lot more primitive. And but it's a wonderful place to historical place.
Was there concern about discrimination against Arab Americans? And was your being there, did that have any effect on perhaps perceptions of that? There have often been talk about discrimination against Arab Americans, and I'm just wondering whether that ever came up.
No, not in those visits, not at all.
Or with people that you talked to while you were there.
No. That's not quite right, in the sense that there was a constant plea, why don't they understand us? And if you really look at the American press, they really don't talk about the Arab world in a positive light. That's where we as American Arabs become very sensitive over that. There's some wonderful things. They're great. They really are wonderful people. They truly are wonderful people. All you hear about is Israel and all the rest of that. It's interesting the way the media treats it. That's subconsciously. I don't think this is a deliberate thing. But probably the best way to explain it would be, I happened to be in Washington, D.C. I don't recall when, 2 years ago. But anyway, on the front page, upper front page, you know, not the underfolded, was a picture of a Israeli soldier that had been killed by a Palestinian. And so here was the picture, and the soldier was on the street, and there was a little trickle of blood, and you could see that. Which, of course, was tragic. But the point that went through my head was, at that point in time, and of course it's changed dramatically since then, at that point in time, this was the first Israeli soldier killed. But at that point, 98 Palestinians had been killed by Israel, not one of which was on the upper front page of any newspaper anywhere.
Right.
And so it was big news that an Israeli soldier was killed. It is not big news that 98 Palestinians have been killed. And so that's a subconscious thing. You see what I'm saying? That this is a real human being, and Palestinians are not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that in the sense that I think they do that deliberately. Maybe, but that's the conscious view in their mind. I suppose the same thing is, there's sort of an abstraction about thousands of Somalians dying of hunger. Well, okay, that's Somalians, you know. There's not that intimacy that we apply like we did apply to that Israeli soldier. So when you talk about discrimination, you know, the American public really doesn't have a good sense of who are the Arabs. Actually, the Iraqi war, Americans learned more about that part of the world than they'd ever learned before.
Sure.
Where is Iraq? Where is Kuwait? You know, where is it?
Yeah.
And so I remember, and I still have, you know, they would have maps. They would show maps of where these countries are. So Americans learned something in that that war. That was, if there was a good fallout, which is, can't be that good, that was one.
Speaking of news coverage, was there any news coverage on your visit?
Only the first one.
Yeah.
Well, there was news coverage over there.
Over there. That's
over
what
there. Yes, yeah. And I've got clippings.
Uh-huh.
But
what was that like? What kind of coverage did you get?
Oh, usually a picture, no further away than maybe the second page or.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the first time the front page, but there's a picture of the governor of Oregon visiting with President Assad. But they would have pictures of others, and they're always sitting in the same, you know, same thing against the wall with
right.
The table in between the two chairs.
Did people have any idea where Oregon was?
Oh, no.
I sometimes wonder about people living on the East Coast of America.
That's right, that's right. No, not generally. Damascus is a very fascinating city. oldest, they say the oldest continuous city in the world. As you drive from the airport into town, you get a real sense of what the Palestinians' plight is, because there's a, let me call it a shanty town, on the way into Damascus where the Palestinians are living. There's, you know, the Palestinians are just scattered all over the place. It was interesting that they have a souk, which, S-O-U-K, which is their small shops in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is a very old one, and it has a cover over it, at least one of the main.
A fabric?
Well, no, it's metal, and it's old.
Uh-huh.
It's up there.
Uh-huh.
I never really inspected it, but it's old. It's kind of a cover. And this would be fairly high because there are buildings in there, three, four stories high, or two to three, something like that. Narrow street and sidewalks. But people use the street and sidewalk, this is all the same thing. And when my first visit, I had, as I told you earlier, motorcycles, you know, a couple of motorcycles and police cars and our own entourage. And I was telling people about that. We snuck into the souk. You know, we went, hey, the siren's going, you know, and roar into the, and when you roar into it with the roof on top of it, and, you know, people are all over the place, you know, they had to get off the streets so the cars could go in there.
Right.
And what's going on here, you know, I said, we snuck into the souk. It was fascinating. I've since, of course, been back to the same souk. Small shops. I mean, small. They one after another. Oh, maybe, what, 6 feet by 7 feet? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a whole shop. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of gold.
Really?
Gold bracelets, uh-huh. Gold chains, gold. They love gold over in that part of the world. And I suppose it's one way for them to get some wealth. And the women have a lot of gold bracelets. And, you know, there's a lot of gold there. So one shop after another shop after another shop, and it all has gold. On my last visit, that was interesting. I don't quite understand it, but there was some kind of a government edict about you had to sell your gold products at a certain price. And if you didn't, you go to jail. You could actually go to jail for it. And
because people had so much of their wealth invested in
I gold? Have no idea why it was a policy. I can't tell you that. Except that on my last visit, you couldn't see gold anywhere.
Huh.
Now, what actually happened is that one of the people that we know and know very well, he knew somebody in the business. And that person knew him, so now there was trust between them. So we went to that shop, and we looked at silver. And we said, gee, I like that. Fine, he said, come back tonight at, I don't know, 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. And so we got that product in gold, a bracelet, or whatever it is that we decided we wanted. That, but they wouldn't do it. I mean, they have it, it's just, they just, because if they sell it, whatever that mandated price was, other than that, they could go to jail. Then they actually, I learned from some others, I was asking questions.
The mandated price being higher or lower?
I think lower. They wanted to sell it lower. They couldn't, didn't want to do it or whatever reason. Incidentally, another kind of interesting sidelight, this man I'm talking about is a doctor. His daughter lives here in the United States. And so he was asking us to spend as much money as we. He gave us the money. He said, and he even gave it to us at black market price. And he wanted to spend as much as possible. Well, what he had in mind is when we got back here, we would send his daughter the money, the American money of what we, the equivalent of what we got in Syria. Hmm. That was his way of getting money out of the country to his daughter.
Huh.
So we used the Syrian pounds as much, he wanted, you know, he wanted us to spend as much as we could, because as much as we could, that'd be more money for his daughter.
Right.
Then when we came home, we wrote a check to the daughter. And that way he could get money to her. And I'm sure there's some of that going on, because they want to obviously support the children and they can't do it. So this is one way to do it. It's fascinating.
How did this person seek you out?
Pardon?
How did this person seek you out? How did you make their your?
Oh, we happen to know him. He actually comes. He actually been in Portland.
Oh,
same man.
I see.
Uh-huh. So we're fully aware of it. Very nice man. Very nice home. I've been in his home. Had dinner there. Both he and his wife are very nice people. He's a doctor. And but that was, you know, that was understood, and we understood what it was all about. When I said earlier they weren't really prepared for tourists, to give you an idea, the rate of exchange at the Sheraton was 12 to 1. Mm-hmm. Today, the rate of exchange at the Sheraton is 12 to 1. The act published official rate by the bank is 20 to 1. Hmm. I mean, that's public. But when you deal with the motel or hotel, it's 12 to 1. Then there's the black market rate, whatever that is. When I was there, it was 45 to 1. That was black market. So you see, you know, you don't want to penalize somebody for going to visit the Sheraton Hotel, which is effectively what you were doing.
Right.
You're getting penalized for doing it.
Right.
And you had to come up with the exact amount, which is not easy to do, incidentally. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So they really don't have the feel of accommodating tourists.
Is there any danger of trading on the black market? I know, and sometimes
I think there always is.
Some there isn't.
There always is, and I'm not sure Americans should be doing it. We weren't out on the street for black market. You could go out on the street for black market. But I had some people approach me on that. But that's not worth the risk. In his case, he had the money.
Right.
So he just said, here, but I'll give it to you at the black market rate. So we were getting a break.
Right.
Incidentally, I bought some that last visit, some bracelets for my daughter, my daughter-in-law, and Dolores, and things like that. It's a whale of a deal. When I came back, I got this, well, not only that, but whatever jewelry we had appraised, but in the case of this gold, the price was six times higher on appraised price here of what I acquired over there.
Gee.
And so it was a whale of a deal. I told him, the Lord said, now don't get me anything, don't get me any jewelry. And I said, when I came back, I know that's what you said, but I just couldn't, it's too good a deal. And as I was leaving, my cousin Sammy Call was there at the same time, but he was staying. And just as I was leaving, I said, Sammy, buy me some of those prayer beads. Now, I got some and I like them. But I said, buy me in gold. Now, I really didn't want necessarily the prayer beads. Mm-hmm. Really, I was buying gold. Mm-hmm. Go buy that for me. Which he did. As I say, it's six times higher here.
Gee.
The way they sell it, you say, well, how much is that? Let's say a bracelet. They'd put it on a scale and weigh it. Then they tell you how much it is.
How did you know it was pure gold or whatever gold it was? I mean, I'm sure it wasn't pure, but
no. But the one thing that's just the nature, and this incidentally is not just Syria, all through the Middle East, they don't deal with anything less than 18 karat. Nothing. I guess how you would assure yourself is that they are more, meaning the people there, are more knowledgeable, and they sure wouldn't want to take advantage of their, obviously, their regular customers. But they don't deal with anything less than 18, 18, 20, 22. Now, I wouldn't know the difference between 18 or 22.
Right.
I know it's at least 18. So, you know, it's good enough for me. Mm-hmm. And 18 is pretty good. But that's also throughout that whole area, whether it's Saudi or Qatar or Kuwait or Syria, you know, throughout that whole area, it's all the same, mm-hmm. same thing. But anyway, that's sort of a sidelight. I did want a Damascus sword. We've heard about Damascus steel and Damascus sword. And I finally bought one back in a small shop in a souk. And
are those the curved swords?
Well, not curved quite that much. I'll show it to you. I've got it hanging on the wall uh-huh. there. Uh-huh. I've always wanted to get one of those. The Saudi in their flag, you know, they've got a real curve on their sword.
Right.
Always wanted to get one of those, but I haven't yet. I did get a little dagger, which I'll show you also. I don't collect those things. To me, it was just the kind of thing I would like in a souvenir of that area. But this suit back in there, incidentally, those are not cheap. They're not giveaways. But I bought what I like, and that guy wanted to really sell me. I said, gee whiz, that's a lot of money. I don't have that kind of money. Anyway, I finally ended up by giving him a check over there.
He must have really trusted you.
He did. But, you know, that was really something. Usually a credit card or cash or something, but he took a check. because I didn't have the money to pay for it. But anyway, I brought it back.
Did you make any contacts for your business, for your rugs or
no.
trade, consulting?
First time was I was governor, and the second time I was governor. And in those cases, I didn't feel it was appropriate to try to do business. The third time, kind of looking, but more visiting Syria and my dad's village and President Assad than anything else. But you know, I'm working on something now that hopefully we might be able to do some kind of business over there. This one happens to relate to wheat because it's a food that they would it's something they need over there. Well, I kind of strayed. I have to get back to 1984. I talked
yes.
about my visit.
But you haven't talked about your visit to Omar.
Now we talk about that. I'm really quite anxious. I had some small memories of my visit to Omar.
When you were six?
When I was six. And I was very curious to say to my, you know, I want to see if what I really think I remember was really the case. And obviously also getting back to my dad's village. We had a lunch and we left late to go to Omar. And Omar was about, oh, maybe less than 3 hours, 2.5 hours away from Damascus. So we got the message, and here now the media is really excited. Channel 6, Channel 2, and the channel and Eugene and the newspapers, but particularly the TV folks. And this is going to be a great show. We got the message from the governor of Homs, which is not only the city of Homs, but apparently the district, which includes my dad's village, wanted us to come to his house. And the answer was, no, we really can't do that. We don't have time. The time related to getting there in daylight, so they would get daylight pictures. So as we approached the city of Homs and the south end of Homs, and all of a sudden our entourage slowed down and stopped, and here are a bunch of other cars, which included the governor of Homs. So I get in the car with him, and his is a Mercedes, and now we're going together to, we're not going to stop, we're going to go on into Omar. I'm a gun collector, so he has the armrest down, and I kind of look down, and I see something that looks like the butt end of a pistol, but it has a kind of a leather cover, which I'm not accustomed to seeing. So I'm kind of, while we're talking, I'm feeling, and sure enough, it's a pistol. So at one point I said to him, I know what that is. I said, that's a pistol, and I'm a gun collector, so that's how I know. He raises the armrest, and it's a 38 Smith & Wesson. He said, here. I said, no. Yeah, here, take it. No. You want the bullets? No, I don't. So, Lon, my security, you know, at another point, when we got to the village, he knew about this story. He said, God, I hope they forget this whole thing, because, you know, we're leaving Syria to go to Israel. You know, what am I going to do with a 38 Smith & Wesson? Anyway, we got to the village and got out of the car. And let me finish that story, because the next day, and he left, the gun went with him. So the next day, we did stop at his house on our way out. And there he formally presented me with this pistol. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that later on. So that visit, I cannot describe adequately. The town, the village, which is not a big village, everybody turned out. Dolores and I walked up these narrow streets. This is a very old village. I guess you'd call them cobblestone streets. Uh-huh. At one point, it is quite narrow. This street we went up, I don't think a car can go from one end of town to the other up this same street. It's quite narrow.